The following is an encore broadcast of Up to Date. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Donald Johanson was just 31 when he set the world on fire with his discovery of a fossil 3.2 million years old that has become known as Lucy. She was then the oldest skeleton of an upright walking human ancestor. Donald Johanson found Lucy in Ethiopia in 1974 when, the story goes, he caught the glint of a white fossilized bone out of a corner of his eye and recognized it as something very special. The discovery brought him the kind of attention that rock stars usually get. His name became synonymous with a new understanding of our human origins, and Lucy has become a cornerstone in human evolutionary studies and continues to inspire expanded exploration. Donald Johanson is director of the Institute of Human Origins at Arizona State University, where he is a professor of anthropology. Dr. Johanson, welcome. So good to have you here.
Well, thank you. I don't think we could have a more beautiful day in Kansas City. I'm very happy to be here.
A great day to go out looking for fossils, right?
Exactly.
Let's go right after the show today. Well, how did the discovery of Lucy, Don, alter the study of human history?
Well, Lucy broke the 3-million-year time barrier.
Yeah.
When I found Lucy in 1974, all the fossils, human fossils, that were older than 3 million years, you could fit in the palm of your hand. Mm-hmm. And here was 40% of a skeleton that had lain in suspended animation for 3.2 million years, eroded out on the surface. I came along, had the great fortune of finding the one single bone out of the elbow that led to the discovery of the rest of the skeleton.
I was going to say, did you just catch it out of the corner of your eye, as the story goes, and there it was? Or how did it happen?
I did. I was walking, looking for fossils. I was headed back to my car to drive back to camp, and I happened to look over my right shoulder. If I had looked over my left shoulder, I probably would have missed this bone. And there it was, a little wrench-like bone that allows you to flex and extend at the elbow. And I recognized the anatomy of it as having coming from a human ancestor.
How was it there? Was it just, had you been doing work in that area, or did you just serendipitously just sort of see it there?
Well, the way we find these fossils is really through foot survey. There's no shortcut. You just have to get out there and walk and look and walk and look and hope that your eyes fall in the right place.
Mm-hmm.
And the year before, on the expedition in 1973, a geologist had found a large skull of a pig. And we had to put that on our maps, put it in accurately so we knew where it came from, what layer it came from. And I was out with one of my graduate students, and I said, well, we'll do some survey in this area. And we didn't find very much, a bit of a monkey, a bit of an antelope. And as we were leaving at the last moment and turning my head in the right direction, my eyes fell on this bone.
What happened next? What did you do?
Well, the next thing that happened was we kneeled down to take a close look at it. Because at first I thought it was so small, it probably was a baboon. But as I kneeled down and was able to pick it up and look at the detailed anatomy, I could see that it didn't come from a monkey elbow. It came from a human ancestor elbow. And as we looked up this slope, we could see other pieces of the skeleton eroding out. And I knew at that moment that we had part of a skeleton. I didn't know how much of a skeleton. I didn't know it was a female skeleton. I didn't know what species it was. I did know that it was probably older than 3 million, maybe as much as 3.4 million. Ultimately, we settled on a date of 3.2 million. But I knew at that moment that this was a major breakthrough in our understanding of human origins.
What was that like at age 31 to stumble across something that really reset the trajectory of your career?
Well, it was a moment of great elation and excitement for me. Certainly, this was a childhood dream to go out and find something like this. I didn't think I'd find something quite as important as the Lucy skeleton. But it was a moment of great excitement for the expedition. This was an incredible reward to all of us who go out there. And when we began to see that there was more and more of the skeleton, the excitement grew in the camp. And everyone thought that this was the real reason, the real reward for why we were out there.
Wow. What did Lucy tell us? Tell us a little more about what she has taught us over the years and the excitement and how that changed anthropology and the work you did.
Well, Lucy, the first major thing that she showed us was that upright walking, bipedalism, which is a very strange way of getting around when you think about it. When you go and look at the world of mammals, almost every mammal we know of, well, every mammal we know of walks on four legs.
Mm-hmm.
We walk upright. We walk on two legs, which is very curious. It's one of the defining features of what it means to be a human. And Lucy's pelvis, a very rare preservation. Pelvis are very fragile. Normally they don't preserve. But contains all the hallmarks of upright walking. Her knee is essentially identical to our own. Her ankle, for example, is identical to our own. And we know that upright walking, at least at that point, went back at least 3 million years. And now we have discoveries from northern Kenya that suggest that it goes back 6 million years. So this
Six million years.
Yeah, yeah. So this is one of the defining features that separates us from our closest living relatives, the chimpanzees and gorillas, for example.
And so at what point, how far back do you have to go in time to figure out when humans actually began to walk on two legs? How far back does that go?
We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
In 1974, it was 3.2 million years. A few years later, it was 3.5 million years, and then 3.7. There are two leg bones from Kenya that suggest that it goes back 6 million years. We don't know how far back it goes.
And what do you make of that?
Well, what we make of it is that it was a primary adaptation. It was what in biology we call a breakthrough adaptation. And that once this happened, there was a new evolutionary trajectory set for the evolution of primates. And we are today all bipeds. We are how many billion on the planet today? So it's apparently a very successful form of locomotion. But we're beginning to think about whether or not it happened more than once. Did bipedalism, upright walking, happen several times, not just once?
Mm-hmm.
Did it have different forms? There have been recent discoveries like Ardipithecus at 4.4 million years, that the discoverers believe walked upright when it came to the ground, but yet it had a large divergent great toe. Was this a compromise situation where in the trees it was climbing and grasping with this large divergent great toe, but when it came to the ground, was it experimenting with upright bipedalism?
Mm-hmm.
Were creatures walking on tops of branches, large branches, in arboreal landscapes? So it's opened up a whole series of new questions, but we know that bipedalism is the first definitive feature that precedes everything else.
Hmm.
We don't get big brains till about 2 million years ago. We don't see stone tools till about 2.6 million years. So you had these creatures walking around for at least 6 million years, at least 4 million years, upright, but with small brains, very ape-like features in their faces and jaws, and probably not much more than a bipedal ape. So it generates a whole series of questions about how did they survive? Why did bipedalism persist? What was so advantageous about being upright?
Mm-hmm.
Well, obviously, it had something to do with freeing the forelimbs from locomotion so that those hands and arms could be used perhaps to carry things. It may also have had an energetic effect. We are built to walk. I live in a city now most of the time in San Francisco where I've given up my car.
Hmm.
I walk all the time. It's an efficient way of getting around. It's a way that we can explore much more widely and that we can penetrate greater distances. So it obviously has a lot of advantages, but it took a long time for that feedback mechanism of larger brain to develop, and that was 4 million years later at least.
Oh, what's your theory as to why it took so long for the larger brain to come along and what was spurring that? What do you think?
Well, I don't know. It's another one of those great questions.
That's not a good answer here. I want answers.
It's one of those great unanswered questions.
Yeah.
If we look at our closest living relatives, the chimpanzees, for example, we know that they do use rudimentary tools, that they will use termiting sticks or blades of grass. We also know, and we've known this ever since Darwin wrote about it, in fact, when Portuguese sailors first saw this in West Africa, that some chimps will use rocks to break open nuts. And they will take these hard-covered nuts that they want to eat the meat inside of these nuts, and they can't crack them open with their teeth. So what they do is they take them to their favorite little place where they have a little anvil that might be made of wood or a naturally occurring larger rock, and they'll put the nut down and they'll use a rock to crack that. Well, maybe around 3 million years ago, 2.5 to 3 million years ago, there were some of these early Australopithecus creatures, as we call them,
mm-hmm.
little tongue twister, that was just a little brighter than another one. And when it struck with a rock, this nut, and cut its finger, there was an aha moment and said, oh, wow, look at that. It didn't say that, but it recognized that there was an implement that could be used now to do something quite different from just bashing. And maybe that led to the use of a tool in cutting flesh in a scavenged body or something.
So when you go to the zoo, Don, to what extent do you watch the chimps and the apes with a sense of interest that maybe goes far beyond how I'd view them?
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because Sunday morning I was filming for the BBC. The BBC is doing a new series on human origins, and they're reconstructing Lucy. And we did the filming at the Oakland Zoo right in front of the chimpanzee cage. And it's fascinating to go to a zoo and to look at these creatures. You look across this what's seemingly a large gap between us and chimps, and if you spend enough time looking at them and not making fun of them, you see that there are a lot of things that remind you of maybe people in your family. The way they act, the way they fool around, the way they look at you. They seem to be as curious about us as we are about them. What trickles through the mind of a chimpanzee when they're looking through that cage at you? I don't know. Who are these funny people? You know, who are these funny hairless individuals? They don't look like us, but yet they do look like us. I don't think chimps really think that. But there is an affinity that you feel right away when you begin to look at chimpanzees. Mm-hmm. And, of course, as you know, there's a movement. My good friend Jane Goodall has certainly spearheaded the movement to move chimps out of these experimental situations, because they experience the same level, the same degree of emotions that we do. And I didn't see it, but there was a special on CNN, I know, on Sunday about these chimps that were being moved from the West down to Florida.
What does she want to see happen?
Well, she wants to see them treated more humanely.
And not place in zoos?
And no, you can't take them out of zoos and reintroduce them, but she wants to see them taken out of concrete 3-foot cubicles,
yeah,
where they're losing their hair. They have no social interaction. We know that one of the worst things that we do in this country, unfortunately, is being in isolation when you put people in solitary confinement.
Mm-hmm.
It is taking away human touch or animal touch, taking away the ability to interact or see or talk with somebody or groom each other as chimpanzees do, has a tremendous emotional negative impact. And she has shown through her work, the longest lasting field study in primates, that these creatures have a very, very human set of emotions.
Hmm. Donald Johansson is our guest. He's director of the Institute of Human Origins at Arizona State University. He discovered Lucy back in the 1970s, a 3.2-million-year-old fossil, the oldest skeleton of an upright walking human ancestor at that time that we knew of. Tell me a little bit more about, go back to Ethiopia in the early 1970s, Don, when you discovered Lucy. What was that place like, and what kind of work did you do to actually uncover her? Walk us through how you do your work.
Well, first of all, you have to go to the right place. If you're going to look for human ancestors that are 3 million years, you're not going to find them in the parking lot of a North American shopping
IGA,
plaza, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So Africa is the place. We know this because not only did Darwin predict this way back in the 1800s, But the first and most ancient fossils in our ancestry have been found in Africa. But you have to find the right place. You can't go to a place that's only volcanic sediments, for example. And a French geologist introduced me to the Afar Triangle up in the northern part of Ethiopia, a part of the Great Rift Valley. And here you have a whole series of lake and river sediments, sands and clays and so on. And we did a preliminary survey in 1972, and the ground was littered with tons of fossils, animals, pigs, rhinos, monkeys, whatever.
And you were in this place again. Why?
I was in this place because he had shown me photographs of animal fossils that he had come across when he was doing geology.
Right.
And I said, I've got to go there. And he said, well, let's go together. And in 1973, we had our first major systematic expedition, and that's when I found a fossil knee joint that's 3.4 million years old. And what you do is you get up every morning, you live in a tent, you live in a very remote place for 2 to 3 months, and you systematically survey, walk the areas using maps to chart your progress. And you look and you look and you look, and when you find something, you may begin to excavate. You may lay out a grid with string and map all of these pieces as you pick them up, and then dig into the hillside and hope to find more.
You dig how? What kind of process is that? What tools do you use?
Well, the first thing we do is we do what's called a crawl. And that is we set up a line of people. We get down on our all fours back to our origins and climb and very systematically pick up every fragment of bone that's on the surface, no matter what it's from. And that's from a particular square. And that goes into a bag, and that goes back to our camp. And back in camp in the afternoons when it's too hot, when it's 110 degrees and you want to sort of stay out of the heat, you systematically go through each and every bone fragment, usually two or three of you, and you'll say, well, you think this might go with the Lucy skeleton? Well, we'll put it in that pile. Well, oh, no, that's a piece of a turtle, so that goes over there. Or here's a piece of elephant tooth or something.
You can tell that right away?
Oh, yes, right away. And then once you get all of these different piles, you catalog them, and then you spend maybe weeks or months trying to fit all the bones back together. And
like a jigsaw puzzle.
Yes, like a three-dimensional jigsaw puzzle.
Sounds like incredibly painstaking work.
It is painstaking work, but it's not everybody's built to do it. We have graduate students who go out to the field and say, I'll let you guys do that, and I'll study them in the lab or something or other.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes a great deal of dedication, because there are people who go to the field like I do for years, for a lifetime, and never make a major discovery. And getting back to the original question you asked, I was 31 years old. I had just gotten my PhD at the University of Chicago. This was a major event. This was the defining moment of my career. And here I was, as they say, barely, you know, dry behind the ears, the ink barely dry on my PhD thesis, and I made a major discovery, and one that generated an enormous amount of interest in human origins. Lucy has become a household name.
Yes.
If someone brings up the name of Lucy, it's like bringing up the name of an old relative, which, of course, in a way she is.
How was the news of Lucy's discovery, how was that greeted in your world and then the media world writ large, Don?
Well, certainly the media gave it enormous attention. She was on the front page of newspapers worldwide when I announced her in 1974.
Did you know that was going to happen the moment you looked over your shoulder and saw her?
Well, I don't think I really did. I was trained in graduate school to be a scholar and a scientist and a researcher, and I knew that there was an interest in human origins, of course, because, after all, we're all interested in ourselves, where we came from. But I didn't know that she would galvanize the public's interest, that she would become the star of the 20th century, one of the most memorable fossils ever found. And I think it's to a large extent because you can see her as an individual.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at a new arm bone or a new foot, there was a new foot, 3.4 million-year-old foot announced a few weeks ago, it doesn't give you the sense of an individual. I think that's why Neanderthals are so interesting. One of the reasons Neanderthals are so interesting, because we have complete skeletons and we have beautiful reconstructions of them. Here was a skeleton that you could see looked like the one in your doctor's office. You know, the one that's hanging on the wall, and he says, this is the bone you broke or whatever. So people identified with her as a person.
And also, Don, you named her Lucy.
Well, I didn't name her Lucy. That's the interesting thing. I had a girlfriend on the expedition,
mm-hmm.
and we were listening to a Beatles tape. I've always been a great Beatles fan.
Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
And Pamela said, you know, if you really think this skeleton is a female, why don't you call her Lucy? And it was kind of a throwaway line. It was sort of like, well, no, I'm a scientist. This has got to have some complicated name like Australopithecus afarensis, as she ultimately came to be known. But by the next morning, just hours later, when we all got up for breakfast, I'm getting my coffee, and someone says, Don, are we going back to the Lucy site? Do you think we'll find more of Lucy's skull? How old do you think Lucy was when she died? And she started to develop a personality. And this BBC program that I alluded to that will be on our public television sometime next year, I think, they've reconstructed the entire skeleton and the entire individual and will bring her to life. And she will probably become even more familiar.
They're bringing her to life how?
I don't know. I think they may have animations.
And they're going to extrapolate from what's there and what she might have been like at that point.
Yeah, because if we saw her walking here in Kansas City, in the distance, we'd be struck by a couple of things. Yeah. One, she's only 3.5 feet tall, so we'd see a short individual, think probably it's a child. She would be walking upright, so she'd be like the rest of us. But as she got closer, we would notice that her arms come all the way down to her knees.
I was going to say, how long were her arms? Were they hanging down?
She had very long arms. Mm-hmm. And why did she have long arms? Because her ancestors spent so much time hanging around in the trees. And arms are very important when you're locomoting in the trees.
Mm-hmm.
But we would also see that she was probably much more hairy than we are today, and that she had a very small brain. So it's an exciting and interesting thing to think about what her life was like. One of the great fantasies, of course, is to be able to go back in time, if we could do that, and sit up on a little branch myself and look down on Lucy and her friends.
And I bet you think about moments like that, scenes like that in your mind with some regularity, right?
I do. And in my most recent book, Lucy's Legacy, I devote a chapter to A Day in the Life and kind of extrapolate. She's not an upright chimpanzee. She's her own unique character. But chimpanzees and Lucy shared a much closer ancestry than we do. So there are probably many things that we see that chimps are capable of. In the Nova series I did a number of years ago, I have a sequence where I have Lucy sitting at a termite hill using a little stick and carefully sticking it into the termite hill and pulling it out and eating termites. And it's a little animatronic. But nobody had ever done that before. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't have proof that she did that, but since chimpanzees do that regularly, and that's a source of protein and amino acids. And today, I prefer termites fried rather than raw. But
to how you eat them?
Yeah.
Literally eat them like Discovery Man on Discovery Channel, the guy who goes out and does all that stuff?
And there are certain groups in Africa, people who regularly eat these as a source of protein. So why not suggest that she was capable of doing something like this? She certainly wasn't living alone. She wasn't living as an individual. So what do chimpanzee troops look like? Well, a typical group of chimpanzees, the kind we most often see in zoos, tend to be multi-male, multi-female. And we suspect that Lucy's group was multi-male, multi-female, since we found a group of fossils in 75 called the First Family, mm-hmm. of males and females, mm-hmm. and infants. Was it female exogamous? Did the females leave the group in which they were born, like chimpanzees? Or did they stay in their own group? Well, we have to conjecture about that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great difference in size between male and female afarensis. Lucy was only 3.5 feet tall. Her mate, if she had one, was probably more like 5 feet. She weighed about 60 pounds. Males weighed upwards of 110 pounds. Well, when you have that much difference in size, was this a harem group like gorillas? I don't think so, because canines are reduced in size. So how were they defending themselves? They weren't using their canines to drive off competitors or predators or whatever. They must have been doing it as a group. So you begin to build an interesting picture about them, but there's so much that we don't know that if someone had the time machine, I'd be the first one in line.
Yeah. On that note, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Donald Johanson about Lucy and the evolution of our species. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. We're visiting with Donald Johanson, who's the discoverer of Lucy, that great fossil found in Ethiopia back in the early 1970s. Let's go to some phone calls here. Some folks been waiting very patiently. Tim from Kansas City, Missouri, you're on with Donald Johanson. Good morning.
Hey, first I'd like to say is, man, I remember when that book came out, and I was a young teenager, and I read it and just tore it up, and I wish I was better in math because I probably would have majored in paleoanthropology, but nonetheless, I chose a different path in life. I'm an amateur paleontologist, but really my question is, what's the latest and greatest type of dating? How do you date those fossils and stuff? Because I'm familiar with carbon-argon dating and from reading your book back in the 70s, but is there some new dating process, and could you explain about that? Because I think there's a lot of people out there.
Yeah. How do you, yeah. How do you date the fossils?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Tim. Mm-hmm. And congratulations. We're all amateurs, you know, paleontologists. Yeah. We still use argon dating, but it is quite a bit, it's refined quite a bit over what we did in the early 70s.
And what is argon dating?
Argon is dating volcanic rocks. One of the things that all of our listeners should know is that you can't date the fossil itself. It's turned into a stone. It has become mineralized. So it's an exact copy of the original living organism. But we find it in context, in a geological stratum. And hopefully there's a volcanic ash nearby, either above or below. In Lucy's case, there was one immediately adjacent to it, and it's dated at 3,180,000 years, plus or minus 20,000 years.
I was going to say, how accurate is that within 20,000 years?
It's very precise. It's very precise. Wow. So that was a volcanic eruption 3,180,000 years ago, plus or minus. And in the old days, or in the early 1970s, and to some listeners, those are the old days, but we used to date a whole rock. And that can lead to significant error because you might have a mixture of older and younger volcanic eruptions. Mm-hmm. Now we can date single crystals. It's called single crystal laser fusion, where you take a single crystal, you put it into a sealed container, and you melt it with a laser beam, and you extract all of the gases out of there. And you run them over a mass spectrometer, and you count the number of argon atoms. And the more argon atoms, the older the eruption. And this can be done on a fraction of a crystal or the entire crystal itself, the size of something that comes out of your salt.
And that wasn't available in the 1970s.
That was not available then.
Yeah.
But now it is. It's used everywhere, and it's incredibly, as they would say, precise.
Yeah. Tim, thanks for the call. Let's go to Ahmed from Kansas City, Missouri. Ahmed, good morning.
Good morning. I'm a physician in the area, and I'm a believer of evolution. But the question I ask is, are we still going through the process of evolution, or has it stopped? And if it's not, what's the next thing is going to happen?
Okay, Ahmed, thanks for the call. And, you know, I seldom use the word believe in evolution. I say to my students when I'm in class, how many of you believe in evolution? And certain hands go up, and they're always surprised when I say, well, I don't. And they say, what do you mean you don't believe in evolution? I said, I don't believe in evolution any more than I believe in gravity. Gravity is a fact, and evolution is a fact. It's a way we explain the diversity of life on this planet. Where we're going is anybody's guess.
Are we still evolving?
But we are still evolving, of course. Mm-hmm. Every time two people reproduce, there's a new mixture. There's a new sort of composition of the DNA, of the genes. Mm-hmm. Each and every one is different from one another. This amount of variation that we see is precisely what natural selection works on. So that while culture is really a buffer to most of the environmental changes around us, as it was not during the time of Lucy, for example, when they were really susceptible to the whims and caprices of environmental change. Mm-hmm. Today, we can intervene, for example, and overcome any of the challenges. But certainly, we are still evolving. We are a species that is global and is globally in touch reproductively. So there's very little major change going on. But who knows how that might change in the future. In the distant past, these creatures were living in very disparate areas, and genes did not exchange over mm-hmm. thousands of miles as they do today, over tens or hundreds of thousands of miles.
And they certainly didn't have a culture impending upon them like we do today, which you just begin to wonder the impacts and the effects of what we're going through these days, Don.
Yeah, and I think it's most important to look outside of ourselves when we talk about evolutionary change. What prompted the potato famines in Sweden in the middle 1800s and the potato famine in Ireland? They had one potato. They had one strain of potato, and a particular bacterium or must or whatever it was, a fungus that came in and killed them all off. If there's no variation, there can be no change. There can be no evolutionary change. And today we have so overbred our crops in this country, not only things like potatoes in Idaho, which are being grown, a particular kind being grown because they sell well at McDonald's, okay? Mm-hmm. We're endangering that species. That if environmental change comes along, it may disappear. Our cattle are the same way. So, yes, evolution is still happening. It happens every day. we don't see it very dramatically because we live for such a short time.
I was going to say, how far back do you have to go in history to begin to notice, take note of evolutionary change?
Well, probably maybe the last 5 years if you go to the hospital. And your doctor said, well, the operation is great, but you have a staph infection, and we don't have anything to cure it, and you may die from it because they have used antibiotics to get rid of all of the susceptible bacteria. But now they've got the one resistant strain, which is called staph. Mm-hmm. That's evolution, and it can endanger your life.
Interesting. Sergio writes this, Don, wondering why did we evolve to walk upright and become smarter and turned out the way we currently are, but why have chimps or other similar species have evolved to some similar state as us? Is our species in danger of degenerating by the abundance of junk TV such as Jersey Shore? I'm wondering about, worried about my fellow young people.
I think we need a whole hour itself to answer that question. Different animals evolve in different directions. Not every animal, every primate can be a biped. Chimpanzees are as successful as we are in their own niche. And they have chosen to live in, or evolution has developed them to live in more forested environments as quadrupeds. And they are as successful as we are, just in somewhat different ways.
Steve from Overland Park writes this, Lucy and her closest relatives have been found in a rather tight geographical area, as you pointed out. What are the chances of finding even older ones in places such as below present sea levels, under present mountain ranges, or elsewhere?
Yeah, this is a good question. Lucy's species, Afarensis, is known in Chad in north central Africa. It's predominantly from Ethiopia and Tanzania, but it's also been found in Kenya. And there are older strata that people are looking in that go back, as we said earlier, to about 6 million years. Beyond 6 million years, the right kinds of geological sediments are missing in eastern Africa. There was a period of either non-deposition or erosion. But there are teams out there digging deeper into the past, and certainly they will find additional things.
You're confident of that?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Why Ethiopia? Why was that where Lucy was found? What's your theory on why that country has proven to be so rich for the work you do?
Well, if one looks at a satellite picture of the Earth, there's a classic one that shows the Horn of Africa. And you'll see that the Great Rift Valley that begins down in Mozambique continues up north through Tanzania and Kenya and into southern Ethiopia. But what we call the Horn of Africa, that pointed sort of thing into the east of Africa, where Somalia and Ethiopia are, mm-hmm. is moving away from Africa several centimeters a year because of continental drift. And it is opening up the Rift Valley, and it is opening up that window into the past. So it is the largest expanse of the Great Rift Valley. It was the most unexplored ever. In 1973, when I found the knee joint, was the first human ancestor fossil found there. And there have been numerous expeditions, and there are still thousands of square kilometers to be surveyed, and there will be many more discoveries out of Ethiopia.
I was going to say, was it like the California Gold Rush revisited after you found Lucy?
Exactly. It was.
Was it?
Yeah, it was like the hominid rush. You know, people were, I've got to go find my little site and put my little stake in. And there were claims made all over the place. And there are, interestingly now, and very rewardingly, a number of important Ethiopian scholars who have taken an interest in this field, some of whom we have trained directly, others who have been trained in other places, but they're making discoveries. We had this 3.4 million-year-old foot discovery announced just a few weeks ago. I was filming in San Francisco with a paleontologist by the name of Zarai, who found a baby skull 3.3 million years old. These guys are running their own expeditions. They are Ethiopian nationals, and they are as excited as we are about the work.
Who funds these expeditions? If they're coming from this country or, I guess, from Europe, who pays for these things? Who's interested enough to fork over the money?
Well, in the United States, we're predominantly supported by the National Science Foundation and the National Geographic Society. Both of those organizations have a long involvement in anthropology and in funding this sort of research.
So when you go over there for a couple of months, Don, to do the work you do in Ethiopia, what's something like that cost with 18 students or whatever it is you take with you?
Well, we don't take that many students. We take, when we're on an expedition, we'll take maybe three or four graduate students, but we have geologists, paleontologists, archaeologists. We have to live in the field for three months or 2 months. We have airfares. We have food. We have to buy vehicles. It's about $150,000 a field season, which is not a great deal, but you still have to raise it.
That's what it costs. How did the Ethiopian government, Don, respond to the work you were doing at that time and to your discovery? How was it received?
Well, that's a fascinating question, because one of the things that bothered me when I found Lucy was that Lucy was kind of an Anglo-Saxon name, and she really deserved an Ethiopian name.
Ah.
And the director general of the Ministry of Culture, who came to the field to congratulate us and to see the find, mm-hmm. even before she was taken to Addis Ababa, to the National Museum, said we should call her Dinkanesh, which is an Ethiopian name, which means she is wonderful.
Ah.
So she has her own Ethiopian name. I was just in Ethiopia in January and visited the major new facilities that the Ethiopian government has built with their own money. This is a third world country that has dedicated an enormous amount of money to a research center with laboratories, encouraging scientists from all over the world to come and study these fossils. I was welcomed, and a number of them even went to the field with me. I brought people to see the exact spot where we have now erected a stone plinth or a stone marker where I found Lucy on November 24th, 1974. And for the members of the ministry, they had never been there. They were as thrilled as ever. And Lucy is still their favorite fossil.
Hey, has that become a place for anthropologists to sort of make a pilgrimage to go see the spot where Lucy was discovered?
Well, I think it will be. It's not easy to get to. But I know that more and more tourists are beginning to learn about this, and the tour companies in Ethiopia are taking people to the exact spot. Hey,
did you recognize it immediately when you were there?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Sure. Had it changed much?
It hasn't changed that much. You can see that there's a little erosion there, but not a great deal.
Is there a chance someday that Ethiopia will be asking for some of its fossils to be returned?
They're all returned. They all live in a safe in Addis Ababa in the National Museum. I felt very strongly that all of these specimens should be in the country of origin. Work together with the Ministry of Culture, the Ethiopian government, to develop these laboratories. They're all in one place. They're back where they were found. And this means that everyone in the world can now come and study them there.
Donald Johansson is our guest. He discovered Lucy back in the 1970s, the oldest skeleton of an upright walking human ancestor. Did Neanderthals and modern humans have encounters of one kind or another? How did that go?
Yeah, Linda Hall Library had a presentation by Brian Fagan recently, who is more interested in the later stages. He's an archaeologist, in fact, but the later stages of human evolution. And until a few years ago, we didn't think that Neanderthals and humans exchanged genes because we felt they were different species. But we now know that most of us as Europeans carry some 2-3% Neanderthal genes in our human genome. Hmm. But we are predominantly, obviously, Homo sapiens. Certainly, there were encounters. Homo sapiens evolved first in Africa about 200,000 years ago. We have the first evidence of modern humans. And they moved out of Africa around 50,000 years ago into Europe at a time when Neanderthals were very widespread. And some of these places, obviously, they exchange genes. But predominantly, Homo sapiens came in with a superior hunting technology, a very sophisticated culture, and were no match for – the Neanderthals were no match for them. So the Neanderthals disappeared and finally left the fossil record about 30,000 years ago.
You know, some significant discoveries have been made down in a seaside cave in South Africa. What was found there?
Oh, this is an extraordinary development. Actually, it's an Institute of Human Origins project. And this is in a place called Mossel Bay, which is near the airport would be George. It's on what's called the Garden Route. And if any of your listeners want to go on vacation somewhere, South Africa is phenomenal.
Mm.
And at any rate, these are caves that have never been submerged. They've never been cleaned out by the ocean. They've always been above sea level. And Curtis Marion, who is a scientist at the Institute of Human Origins at Arizona State University, has begun to explore these. And
why? What made this scientist figure out this was the place to go?
Well, he knew that he had done a survey, and he knew that these caves contained lots of stone tools and artifacts, and the butchered and cooked remains of various animals, and a high density of seashells, and knew that there had been occupations. He didn't know exactly how old they were. He suspected from the shape of the tools that they were what's called Middle Stone Age, which is somewhere between, say, 70,000, 150,000 years ago. And he's found regular exploitation of sea resources, lots of, what do you call them, mussels that were collected and routinely used to eat. He's got fire pits. He's got the use of engineering to heat up rock 150,000 years ago to make it more homogeneous so it's easier to make stone tools. That's a particular development that's very unique. They've got blade tools. Tools that look more like the knife on your table that don't appear in Europe till 40,000 years ago. They're 80 to 100,000 years ago. So it looks like many of the innovations that made us culturally modern happened in Africa, and the Africans brought them along as they came into Europe.
How high above the ocean surface are these caves?
Well, these caves, they vary. They can be 30 feet, 50 feet, 100 feet.
And difficult to get into?
Well, he's had to build his own staircases down to them.
Have you been in?
Oh, yes. I've been to the caves, and I will be back there in June, especially the ones in Mossel Bay where Curtis Marion is working. And it's a remarkable window into our more recent past.
My goodness. Cheryl from Liberty. Cheryl, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. I was calling to find out if there's an opportunity for volunteers to work on these digs.
Well, that's a great question. We do have a field school out of Arizona State University every couple of years for students in anthropology, and they get a chance to travel to Ethiopia and to work in the field for 4 weeks. But there really aren't any opportunities at the moment for people to come out and volunteer.
Okay, thanks so much.
Sorry, Cheryl. How do the students take to the work that you have to do? You were saying that some of them lose interest sometimes rather quickly.
Well, you know, it always looks very romantic in the pages of National Geographic and when I give a presentation like I am this evening at the library. But when you get out there and you walk into your tent and there's a carpet viper that if it bit you, you could die, or there are people coming down with malaria in camp, or people suffering from dysentery, or every day in, day out, it's 105, 110 degrees. It's only those who really have the passion who want to stay in the field and do that sort of work.
Where did that passion in your life come from, Don?
Well, I began my interest in anthropology when I read a book called Man's Place in Nature, which was published by Thomas Henry Huxley. I grew up in Hartford, Connecticut. There was an anthropologist who lived down the street and introduced me to his library. And that's how I got interested in human origins. I was fascinated with the idea that we shared a common ancestry with the present-day apes and that someday fossils would be found that would reinforce that idea, and I wanted to be one of those people.
What was it in your background that sparked that kind of fascination? Where did that come from?
Well, it came from the encounter with this anthropologist. My father died when I was 2 years old, so I never knew him.
Mm.
And my mother was not educated. There weren't any books in my house. But meeting this anthropologist, walking his dog, and being invited to his apartment and seeing his library opened up a whole new world for me.
How quickly were you out in the field actually digging around? Would you go out in the backyard and dig around?
Well, I didn't dig around so much. I was originally interested in biology and would go out and collect salamanders and butterflies and bugs and watch rabbits and observe birds, and bought a telescope when I was 12 years old and went out and did drawings of the moon's surface and so forth and so on. So I was interested in the natural world in general.
Has the work ever become routine for you?
Oh, not at all. The work is it was such a wonderful field to get into, paleoanthropology, human origins, because at the time I got into it, it was really in a mess. We knew very little, and to have been able to participate over all of these years and see the field grow, the evidence grow, the ideas become more solidified. Every day you walk into the lab, every day you're in the field is an exciting one.
You caught it at exactly the right time.
I did.
And you helped create it.
I did indeed, yes. And our students have gone on, and some of them have made wonderful discoveries both in the lab and in the field.
How popular a field is anthropology these days, Don?
Well, we have quite a few students applying to graduate school. And my classes at Arizona State University are close to 200 students. The introductory course, I think, to anthropology has several thousand students.
Really?
So there is an interest. It is the study of humankind. That's from the Greek anthropos. And we are interested in ourselves, culturally, physically, biologically, etc. And paleoanthropology gives us a time frame in which to place ourselves.
What do these students do once they've been through, they go to graduate school, what do they do then?
Well, it depends on what they're particularly interested in. Some end up going out and living in the field and studying live primates. Others go out and attach themselves to an expedition. Others work in laboratories. Usually the jobs that these people get are associated with universities as professors, but also at museums.
We spoke with paleoanthropologist Donald Johansson in April. You'll find more information about our guests and our program at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow, join us for another encore broadcast as our DVD gurus share their favorite films from 50 years ago, 1962. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman and Danny Alexander. Let's end today's program with another Grammy-nominated local performance, hometown mezzo-soprano Joyce DiDonato and the Kansas City Symphony and their PBS Summer Arts Festival homecoming performance. You're sure to recognize this piece. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.
the chimney tops, that's right.